From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, tensions between Israel and Hamas. The latest on the crisis in eastern Ukraine. Europe considering fracking to cut Russian gas imports. Plus, World Cup 14 2014 goes to Germany. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is blaming Hamas for civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip. Israel extended its bombardment of Gaza for a sixth day on Sunday. Its offensive is aimed at ending Hamas's rocket attacks on Israel. Palestinian officials say the Gaza death toll has reached more than 160, including militants, women and children, and more than 1,000 have been injured. Israel's military carried out its first ground operation in Gaza on Sunday, with commandos targeting a rocket-launching site during the brief raid. Authorities say four Israeli soldiers were slightly wounded. We get more now from VOA's Michael Bowman.
After more than 1,300 Israeli airstrikes and with soldiers and tanks massed at Gaza's borders, Prime Minister Netanyahu is discussing Israel's goals, not intended methods to achieve them.
Our goal is to achieve sustainable quiet and security for our people, and we're doing that by degrading Hamas and other terror capabilities.
The Prime Minister appeared on the U.S. television program CBS's Face the Nation. Asked about a mounting death toll in Gaza, Mr. Netanyahu said Israel uses its missile defense system to protect civilians, while militants in Gaza use civilians to shield their missiles.
I'm not going to say right now how and when that goal will be achieved. We're sorry for any accidental civilian death, but it's the Hamas that bears complete responsibility for such civilian casualties.
Neither Israel nor Palestinian militants appear willing to agree to a ceasefire as urged by the United Nations Security Council. Israel has dropped leaflets in portions of Gaza urging civilians to evacuate. Officials in Gaza say such warnings should be ignored.
VOA's Michael Bowman reporting. Iraqi militants have attacked a town north of Baghdad, seizing local government buildings, killing at least six people there. Officials say the assault about 80 kilometers north of the capital began early on Sunday, and government forces recaptured that town of Diluya last month, after it was overrun by militants linked to the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. A new militant drive toward Baghdad appears to be underway again. Meantime, Iraq's deadlocked parliament adjourned on Sunday after failing to choose candidates for top positions, a necessary step toward forming a new government. Legislators plan to meet again tomorrow. Overnight, an audio recording emerged that is purportedly from the one-time deputy of executed dictator Saddam Hussein. Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri praised the advance of the ISIL militants and called for the overthrow of the Baghdad government. Jordanian authorities said Sunday the shooting death of a Syrian rebel commander in Amman last week appears to be the part of a family dispute. They're downplaying claims from the Syrian opposition that the killing was politically motivated. Police are searching for two Syrians suspected of shooting Maher Rahal late Friday. Rahal was head of the Liwa Mujahideen Brigade, one of the groups fighting to topple Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. While security officials and relatives are linking the slaying to a family feud, the opposition Syrian National Coalition publicly blamed the Syrian government. Rahal arrived in Jordan for a family visit days before his death. The Libyan government is calling for an end to fierce militia clashes near the capital that killed six people and injured 25 on Sunday. Prime Minister's spokesman Ahmed Al-Amin said at a news conference that the regional armed groups fighting to control Tripoli International Airport were acting, in his words, without any orders or legitimate cover from the government. The violence broke out early on Sunday when armed Islamists attacked Zintan militiamen who had controlled the airport since the ouster Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and three of his European counterparts have joined talks in Vienna to press Iran for more concessions on its nuclear program. At next Sunday's deadline is looming. We go now to Vienna and VOA's Al Pessin for the story.
Secretary Kerry flew into Vienna overnight from Afghanistan to join the discussions and meet with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. Kerry arrived shortly after a senior U.S. official involved in the talks told reporters some of Iran's positions are inadequate and unworkable. Officials say an agreement on long-term limits on Iran's nuclear program and an end to international economic sanctions is 70% finished, but that significant gaps remain on key issues. Those are believed to include how much capacity Iran will retain to enrich uranium, a potential fuel for nuclear bombs, and how long the restrictions will last. Arriving for the talk Sunday morning, Secretary Kerry described the situation this way.
Obviously, we have some very significant gaps still. So we need to see if we can make some progress. And I really look forward to a very substantive and important set of meetings and dialogues. And we obviously, this is a very important subject. It is vital to make certain that Iran is not going to develop a nuclear weapon, that their program is peaceful.
The UN Security Council deputized its five permanent members, the United States, France, Britain, Russia, and China, plus Germany, to negotiate with Iran on measures to guarantee that its nuclear program is purely peaceful, as Iran says it is. But Iran has violated past agreements on the nuclear program, ignored resolutions from the Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency, and pursued secret military nuclear research. So the international community wants strict, verifiable controls to ensure that if Iran does decide to build a nuclear bomb, the project could not be kept secret and would take a year or more. That would provide time for diplomatic or potentially military moves to stop it. Iran expert Matthew Morin of London's King's College says the experience of past failed agreements with Iran is an important factor in these talks.
The international community has learned a lot from its past experience of negotiating with Iran. So there is pressure to reach an agreement, but I don't think that an agreement will be rushed. We're talking about a lasting solution to one of the key problems on the international security agenda, and that's not something that can be taken lightly.
These talks follow a preliminary agreement reached in December that resulted in some rollbacks of Iran's nuclear program in return for limited relief from economic sanctions. The two sides agreed to negotiate a comprehensive agreement within 6 months, giving themselves a July 20th deadline. They also provided the option of extending the preliminary accord for a further 6 months to allow more time to settle disagreements. But an extension also creates problems. Officials are concerned that momentum toward an agreement could be lost, that international sanctions could weaken, and that the U.S. congressional elections in November could make it harder to get sanctions relief approved. In addition, Iran has indicated that it wants more easing of sanctions as part of any extension, something U.S. officials say they're not willing to provide. Last year, it took two interventions by foreign ministers to finalize the preliminary agreement. This is their first visit to these talks, and the Russian and Chinese ministers were not able to get here. So the ministers could be back again next weekend for a final push. Al Pessin, VOA News, Vienna.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist. And she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
Russian media say a shell fired from inside Ukraine struck a Russian border town, killing one person, wounding another. Reports say the shell landed Sunday in the Russian town of Donetsk, same name as that of a region in Ukraine. Associated Press quotes a Russian official as saying the incident would be met with an appropriate response, but gave no further explanation. On Saturday, the European Union said it's placing sanctions on 11 leaders of the pro-Russian rebellion in eastern Ukraine, including the separatist leader Alexander Borodai. Rebels have declared independence for the region and have been fighting Ukrainian government troops. Borodai is a Russian citizen who has declared himself the prime minister of Donetsk region in the eastern part of Ukraine. EU has already imposed sanctions on many other people and businesses involved in the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Meantime, the human rights group Amnesty International says dozens of people in eastern Ukraine have been abducted and tortured by armed pro-Russian separatists in recent months. Ukrainian government forces are also accused of the abuses. Henry Ridgewell is in London with our report.
Several weeks after she was abducted and tortured, pro-Ukrainian activist Hannah still wears bandages to treat her wounds. She was kidnapped from her Donetsk apartment by pro-Russian separatists and taken away blindfolded. Hannah describes what happened. My face was smashed, she says. They were trying to beat me everywhere. I was covering myself with my hands. Then they cut my hands and legs with a knife. Hannah describes how she was forced to write a separatist slogan on the wall in her own blood. She says, the man who was brutalizing me said, write with your blood on the wall, I love Donbass. And he said, if you can't do this, if you run out of blood, I will shoot you. Hannah's harrowing account is far from unique, according to Amnesty International. Researcher Denis Krivoshiv has documented dozens of allegations of torture by separatist groups in eastern Ukraine.
Mostly it's pro-Ukrainian activists, those who insisted that East is part of Ukraine, who wanted to use Ukrainian flags, shout Ukrainian symbols, slogans. They were the ones targeted primarily, but also people who were involved with the presidential election on the 25th of May, members of electoral committees, of observers. Also journalists.
Amnesty says there is an increasing number of pro-Ukrainian activists escaping the East and arriving in the capital, Kiev. Sasha says he was abducted after attending pro-Kiev protests in Luhansk last month.
They told me goodbye, they are going to kill you, so... And one guy with a gun put the gun to my head and said to go straight the corridor and don't send anything. While I was walking through the corridor, armed people who were there, they told me goodbye, they are going to kill you, so...
Amnesty says many of the alleged kidnap and torture victims are only now coming forward after being freed by Ukrainian forces. In recent days, the Ukrainian military has made territorial gains, forcing pro-Russian separatists from their strongholds in Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. But both Ukrainian government troops and pro-Kiev activists also stand accused of carrying out abductions and torture, though on a much smaller scale. Ukraine's government must end the culture of impunity, says Amnesty's Denis Krivoshiv.
All over Ukraine, police have been a force that whose members have been regularly abusing people's rights with impunity. And if Kyiv authorities are really intent on reinstating the rule of law and putting the house in order, this is where they need to start.
Justice may have to wait while the conflict goes on. Pro-Russian separatists are reinforcing their positions in Donetsk and Luhansk. Analysts say any battle for control of those cities would likely cost many lives. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The political crisis in Ukraine, including its dispute with Moscow over the flow of Russian natural gas, has forced many European nations to reconsider their reliance on Russia for energy. Some nations are looking at a new option for extracting natural gas at home, including hydraulic fracking. But as Anna Hauntz-Ward reports, fracking is controversial.
Although much of Europe is dependent on Russian energy imports, the continent is believed to be sitting on 13 trillion cubic meters of shale gas, a significant reserve. France, Poland, and Ukraine share the largest amounts of shale gas, but reserves have also been found in Romania, Bulgaria, and the United Kingdom. Lucia Seibert at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. says the presence of large shale gas reserves and the current crisis in Ukraine have sharpened the focus on Europe's shale gas potential.
With energy security, it's not just a matter of supply, it's also a question of reliability. And one thing that this may do, it may expedite some of these explorations of shale gas within the European Union.
Still, Europe is believed to be years away from commercially exploiting shale gas. Poland, the United Kingdom and Romania are the furthest along and expect to start exploration by 2020. But extracting shale gas using a technique called hydraulic fracking is controversial. Most drilling sites in Europe are near populated areas, and environmental groups have raised concerns about water and air pollution. There are also political issues. Eric Stewart is the president of the Romanian American and Polish American Business Councils. He says European taxes on the industry and strict regulations create a challenge for extraction companies.
It is much more complex in extracting the gas out of places like Poland and Central Europe than it is in the U.S. It's much simpler in the U.S. So we really need to better understand how much is there and how easily we can get it out of the ground.
Energy companies also must battle a strong environmental movement and public opposition. Keith Smith, a former U.S. ambassador to Lithuania, is a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis and an expert on the fracking technology. He says the process can help meet Europe's energy needs if it complements conventional and renewable sources of energy, like solar and wind.
I think hydraulic fracturing is one element that can help bring energy security to Europe, but it'll take a long time. But I think it can happen, but it's one factor. And there's a lot of other things that need to be done.
Much of Europe's gas flows through a pipeline that runs from Russia across Ukraine. But Ukraine has had trouble paying its gas bill to Russia's Gazprom energy company. And earlier this year, Ukrainian protesters ousted the country's pro-Russian president. The new government has signed economic agreements with the European Union over Moscow's objections. Moscow has signaled it may cut off gas to Kiev and thus to much of Europe. With winter approaching, the current dispute looks similar to the crisis in 2009, when Russia stopped the natural gas flow to Europe in January, leaving millions of homes and businesses in the cold. Again, Lucia Seibert.
The European Union has got burned, or frozen, I should say, with the 2009 crisis, right? And so they really worked hard to prevent something like that from recurring. And there's been much talk about the interconnections with pipelines and, you know, sort of alternative sources and reverse flow mechanisms and so on. So we will see.
Lucia Seibert says shale gas exploration will not achieve complete energy independence from Russian imports, but will lessen that dependence long term. That would be beneficial for both Europe and Russia, a country that needs a more diversified economy and less dependence on energy exports. Anna Hontz-Ward, Voice of America, Washington, D.C.
Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a nuclear energy cooperation deal with Argentina on Saturday. Mr. Putin is on a trip to bolster trade ties and strengthen Russia's influence in Latin America. Tell reporters in Buenos Aires that the Russian State Atomic Energy Corporation had made an offer to tender for the construction of two new nuclear power units in Argentina. He said it could offer comfortable financial terms to Latin America's number three economy, which has struggled to advance its nuclear energy program and lure foreign investors deterred by a raft of punishing capital and import controls. Mr. Putin made an unannounced stopover in Nicaragua after meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro in Havana on Friday. And in Brazil, of course, he was there for the final game of the World Cup. We'll tell you more about that in a moment. He'll also be taking part in bilateral talks and a summit of the emerging BRICS economies. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. That'll be tomorrow and Wednesday.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Well, it all got started about a month ago when the World Cup host Brazil took on Croatia and won that game 3-1. And on Sunday, 63 matches later, the final match was played between Argentina and Germany. And in extra time, Germany won 1-0 to become the winner of the 2014 World Cup. This is Germany's first win of the World Cup as a united country. West Germany won the World Cup in 1954, 1974, and 1990. And the 2018 World Cup will be held in Russia. It plans to host the games in 12 stadiums in 11 cities. Beyond two stadiums in Moscow, venues for the matches will be stretching from the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad on the Baltic Sea to Yekaterinburg in the Ural Mountains. And before we say goodbye to the World Cup 2014 in Brazil, we return one more time. Brazil, that's right. Trying to pronounce it correctly, didn't do too well. We return one more time to Rio de Janeiro, where you might not expect to find a hotel in one of the city's favelas. That's the local name for shanty towns. Well, VOA's Brian Allen has the unlikely success story of The Maze. Though it's located in one of the poorest parts of the city, it has also been named as one of the best places to hear live jazz music in the world.
Nearly everywhere you go in Rio de Janeiro, you're always close to an informal settlement, also known as a favela. More than 11 million Brazilians live in these poor communities, famous for the colorful but often dangerously constructed buildings, dense population, and in some cases, the drug trade and associated crime. In hotels, brochures advertise favela tours, next to pamphlets for helicopter rides and boat excursions. But one man has gone far beyond treating Rio's favelas as just another tourist adventure. 35 years ago, Bob Nadkarni moved in. Welcome to The Maze. It started as a quiet art studio for the British expatriate. Slowly, he expanded the space and ultimately opened his sprawling home with one of the best views of Rio de Janeiro to friends and family.
I built this house over 30-odd years. It's not just a house. It's like a work of art. You know, it's a sculpture that people live in and find their way through. It's called The Maze because it's a place where people come to lose themselves and find themselves, as indeed I have.
Nadkarni was instrumental in helping clean up the Tavares Bastos favela, where The Maze is located. For years, he says, it was run by gangs and drug lords. He convinced the controversial favela pacification police to set up shop here, permanently. In 2005, The Maze became a hotel.
As my wife said, my friends treat me as a hotel anyway. I thought, well, you know, I am a hotel. Well, I did build a few more rooms, and that's why I opened it up.
In recent years, the guest house has developed a reputation as a world-renowned jazz club. Downbeat magazine, an influential music publication, lists it as one of the best jazz venues in the world. Nadkarni says the now famous jazz night, the first Friday of every month, started small.
We had a party with a few friends of mine playing jazz, and there were 12 people here, and they all liked it so much. They suggested we do it again, so they all brought three friends the next month, and it was then 40 people, and you know, and so it became geometric, and now I don't ever get less than 500 people at the jazz night.
The Maze has even raised its prices, trying to keep the attendance manageable, but people still flock in. For Nadkarni, that's just what he wants.
I get, you know, with a house full of all kinds of people. You know, I get a lot of artists and poets and writers and filmmakers and musicians here, but I get these amazing, interesting people here. It's a place where people meet and exchange ideas and bounce off each other.
The morning after jazz night, life at The Maze is quiet again. The space is empty and the people are gone, but the gorgeous panoramic views remain. Nadkarni's wife helps their daughter with her homework, in the same spot that was packed with people and alive with music just hours before. Brian Allen, VOA News, Tavares Bastos, Rio de Janeiro.
And many thanks to Brian and everyone else in Rio and the rest of Brazil who've covered the World Cup for us. Once again, Germany wins the World Cup with Sunday's extra time match. Final score, Germany 1, Argentina 0. Now let's listen one last time, probably, to the bit of this year's World Cup theme song. thanks, everyone, for joining us on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. One love, one life, one world, one fight, whole world, one night, one place. This is Today in History. On July 14, 1789, the notorious Paris prison, the Bastille, was attacked and taken over by a mob, an event seen as the beginning of the French Revolution. Bastille Day is a French national holiday. On this day in 1798, the controversial Sedition Act became law in the U.S. The law made it a crime to speak or write what were called false, scandalous, and malicious accusations against the U.S. government. Several government opponents were prosecuted and jailed under the law. Heavily criticized as unconstitutional, the law was allowed to expire at the end of President John Adams' term in office. In 1913, former U.S. President Gerald R. Ford was born. Ford took office following President Richard Nixon's resignation during the Watergate scandal. On this day in 1918, renowned Swedish movie director, producer, and screenwriter Ingmar Bergman was born. In 1933, all political parties in Germany were outlawed except the Nazi Party of dictator Adolf Hitler. That action by the Reichstag was part of the process by which the Nazis established their totalitarian regime. In 1946, Dr. Benjamin Spock's Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care was published. It became the child-rearing Bible for parents of the baby boom generation. On this day in 1958, Iraq's Hashemite monarchy was overthrown. Abdul Karim Qasim became the country's leader. He, in turn, was overthrown in the 1963 Ba'athist coup. On this day in 1965, the U.S. unmanned Mariner 4 became the first spacecraft to fly past the planet Mars, returning close-up pictures of the Martian surface. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There were many notable outcomes at the recently concluded 26th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council, or UNHRC, in Geneva, Switzerland. The Council adopted its first ever resolution on human rights in Ukraine, calling for continued cooperation and monitoring of the human rights situation throughout the entire country, and condemned ongoing abuses taking place in Russian-occupied Crimea and committed by separatists in the eastern parts of the country. U.S. Ambassador to the UNHRC, Keith Harper, said the resolution will offer an opportunity for the High Commissioner's Office to have a more sustained role in Ukraine.
It will also help in technical assistance in the sense of aiding to understanding how do you address problems that arise. Sometimes they arise with state actors, oftentimes they arise with non-state actors. And so how do you deal with those issues? The High Commissioner's Office has great experience in that.
The Human Rights Council, or HRC, passed its 14th resolution regarding the Syrian conflict, condemning serious abuses of human rights and violations of international humanitarian law in Syria, lamenting the lack of an international criminal court referral, and reiterating the international community's demand for unfettered humanitarian access in Syria.
The Assad regime is a murderous regime, and they are killing their own people. And so whatever action we can take at the Council to push them to find a political solution, in my view, is action that we ought to take. So when we see these grave human rights abuses, it's incumbent on the Council to continue to act. They did continue to act. They ratcheted up the response. For the first time in the operative paragraphs, we called for accountability through either domestic or international criminal bodies.
On South Sudan, the HRC adopted a consensus resolution that condemned human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law, including targeted killings, unlawful recruitment of child soldiers, and sexual violence and rape that has occurred since mid-December 2013. The outcomes of this session underscored the importance of robust U.S. engagement at the Human Rights Council, where the United States continues to work with a diverse range of countries from all regions to address urgent human rights concerns. U.S. leadership continues to help keep the Council at the forefront of international efforts to promote and protect human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.